A few years ago, my brother got married in, he's not a believer, and guess what passage he had preached? The preacher there in a church that we had no connections with, the preacher told us that we didn't really need to listen to Paul's views on marriage, but his views on love were pretty good. A couple of years later, my cousin got married. Guess what passage she housed? She's also a non-Christian, and she asked 1 Corinthians 13, and I got to preach it, and it was pretty difficult to do, because as we'll see, the context is not really about weddings and marriages. At first sight, it looks slightly out of place, 1 Corinthians 13, in amongst chapter 12 and chapter 14, which is talking about tongues and prophecies, and it does seem a little bit like Paul has misfiled his wedding sermon and put it in the wrong place in the book of Corinthians. But in truth, it is carefully written to communicate just what he needs to say at this stage of the argument, forming a bridge between chapter 12 and chapter 14. Do you remember what we said all those weeks ago before we had the mini-series on Isaiah? You've got to engage your brains all the way back those 3-4 weeks. And as we began to look at chapter 12, we saw that Paul was addressing a question raised by the church. And we said that the question was generally went like this: who is spiritual? And there were those in the church who were saying, look, it's us, we're the spiritual ones, we can speak in tongues, we can prophesy, we're the spiritual ones. And then there were others in the church who couldn't speak in tongues and didn't prophesy, and they were saying, well, no, we're the spiritual ones. Those kind of gifts of tongues and prophecy, are they not more connected with the temples and paganism and idolatry? And Paul's answer in verse 3 was to say, no, the ones who are spiritual are all those who profess that Jesus is Lord. Those who are spiritual are those who profess that Jesus is Lord. In other words, all of us who are believers are spiritual. And then we saw how he went on to say that the church had been given a great variety of gifts and they've been given for the common good. And then we saw that actually we're a body and we need one another and the gifts are given to build up the church. And Paul will go on to say in chapter 14... that we then need to be careful how we exercise these gifts for the good of the body and how we seek gifts that build the body up. And sandwiched in between is chapter 13. Because what we need above all else is love. It's what Paul calls chapter 12, verse 31, the most excellent way. See, the Corinthians, remember, were convinced that they were spiritual because of their gifts. But Paul wants them to understand, and in turn us, that actually the chief mark of spirituality is not certain abilities, but love. The most important thing when speaking of gifts is love. And so, verses 1 to 3, he speaks of love's importance. Philip, sorry, can we? That's all right. So I failed miserably with that sermon handout this morning. I printed it out. I did it. I printed it out. I left it on the desk and forgot to bring it. So I'm sorry. But you can take notes still. I'm using the headlines from here, and it will give you what was in the sermon sheet. So the first thing then, verse 1 to 3, he speaks of love's importance. And he begins the chapter by mentioning again that gift that was most highly regarded by the Corinthians and says, chapter 13, verse 1, if I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. And we know from chapter 14 that it was common that when the church in Corinth met, that for some of them to speak in tongues, which no one else understood. They were speaking a spiritual language. And Paul says there that in chapter 14, without interpretation, such speaking does no good to anyone except the speaker. So you see that in chapter 14, verses 7 to 11 and verses 18 to 19. In other words, such a use of the gift of tongues in a church meeting is unloving. If there's no interpretation. because it's not concerned with the effect that it may have on others. And is of no value to the church, or is of no more value to the church than a cacophony of sound that was a regular part of pagan worship, in which it was common for gongs and cymbals to be sounded that would drive away the demons and invite, as it were, the gods to come and partake. And Paul's saying, look, your meetings, oh, they can be full of supernatural happenings. You can be speaking in tongues, in languages that seemingly of the angels. But without love, it's just a big loud noise. It's no different to paganism. And then he says, look, love is not only more important than the gift of tongues, which the Corinthians valued so much, but it's also more important than the gift that Paul most prized. He continues, verse 2. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but have not love, well, then I am nothing. I mean, you can have prophetic insight. You can fathom all mysteries, and yet no matter how reliable your information comes from it, it's intrinsically valueless, says Paul, if it operates without love. If it's not concerned with the building up of others. If it's not motivated by concern for others. In other words, look, I could preach brilliant sermons. I could lead outstanding Bible studies. I could know my Bible from cover to cover. I could be able to give confident answers to any theological question. I could understand God's ways deeply, be able to discern his message for every individual and situation. I might be so full of faith, I could move Mount Everest to London. And yet without love, Paul says I'm nothing. Valueless. Without point. If it's not concerned with the building up of others. And Paul couldn't have not have made his point more strongly than he has, but he goes on, verse 3. If I give all I possess to the poor and surrender my body to the flames, but have not love, I gain nothing. I mean, he thinks of the most dramatic examples of personal sacrifice, a willingness to give up all you own, to lay down your life. And yet Paul says, even such self-sacrificing acts are of no value in the sight of God without love. It's meaningless if it's not concerned for the building up of others. Do you see, Paul is seeking to challenge and confront the Corinthians' false view of spirituality. Oh, they love the outward displays. They love the dramatic. They love the impressive. But God looks at the heart. God looks at whether it's driven by love, a concern for others. I have to confess, there have been times in my Christian life where I've desired to be more spiritual. And by that I mean to have the gifts that are more dramatic, more impressive, so that people could look at me and think, wow, he's spiritual. And yet the truth is, sadly, I don't think I've ever been so quick to desire love. To love others. Now, it's true that Paul argues here and encourages them to desire spiritual gifts and especially prophecy. But first and of most importance, he wants them to seek love. First fruit of the Spirit, Galatians 5:22, is love. The mark of a believer, according to Jesus in John 13:35. Love. See, how will the world know that you are my disciples? You will love one another. I mean, the very definition of God, who we're called to imitate and be like, is love. 1 John 4:8 and 1 John 4:16. God is love. Love is of first importance. Love is what marks the church and Christ's body. Without love, everything's just a loud clanging noise. It's valueless, it's meaningless, it's nothing. I mean, we can gather on a Sunday morning like this. We can sing theologically precise songs. We can have theologically rich and well-applied sermons. We can have the best coffee and the best children's groups. But without love, it's nothing. It's meaningless. It's valueless. See, here's the thing. It's possible to be spiritual without having certain gifts. But it's not possible to be spiritual without love. Love, says Paul, is of first importance. Love is indispensable. What is it you seek? An impressive looking spiritual gift. To have great theological information. To have brilliant head knowledge. To be thought of as wise. Or to be one who loves. Without love, all gifts are worthless, says Paul. Valueless. And then he goes on, verses 4 to 7. He then tells us what love is, what it looks like. Love is. Remember the cartoons in the papers of a couple that were kind of designed back in the 1960s by a New Zealander and two little boy and a girl, and they'd sit there and they'd put love is ... mowing the lawn together, you know. Love is sharing a bar of chocolate, as long as it's big enough to make sure you have enough. In our house. You know, love is. And Paul says this is what it is, verse 4 to 7. When it comes to love, this is what it looks like. Now, they're probably the most familiar and have made moral eyes moist at weddings than any other verses in Scripture. And because of that, we can think of these verses kind of wrongly or unhelpfully. And so we need to understand a few things before we kind of work out what he's saying. Firstly, we need to understand that Paul is not speaking here of romantic love or the mutual affection of a friend. The Greek has words for both of those emotions. Paul uses a different word here. He's using the word agape, which speaks not so much of an emotion, but an attitude that expresses itself in action. It's a verb. It's dynamic. It's active. It's a settled disposition of mind and heart and will to do good to others, to move outwards towards others. Secondly, it's not a hymn of love, nor is it all that can be said of love. If Paul wanted to do that, he'd have just pointed us to Jesus, the perfect model of love, the one who perfectly moves out towards others. And of course, all that is said here is reflected in Jesus and can be seen in his life and no more so than on the cross. But Jesus is not in the forefront of Paul's mind as he describes the qualities of love in these verses. See, Paul is thinking, above all, of the Corinthians. And in fact, he's writing to shame them. He wants to reveal how far they have fallen short of the standards of love that God demands. You see, if you were to flip, that is, turn each sentence, remove the negatives, these verses would describe the Corinthians to a T. You know, they're impatient and unkind. And envious and boastful and proud. And actually, it reveals how far they've fallen short of what it is to love. And all that Paul says positively of love is not seen in the Corinthian church. See, verse 4, firstly, love, says Paul, is patient and kind. And yet they were impatient and unkind. They didn't long suffer. They didn't bear up with whatever it took to go on serving Jesus and his body. They did not actively seek the good of others. See, in chapter 11, we read, if you remember, that they weren't even prepared to wait for poorer members of the church to arrive before they stuffed themselves at the church meal. Chapter 11, verse 21. And then they did nothing to ensure that there was anything left for latecomers. In love, they're impatient, unkind. See, love bears with those who are not as spiritually mature. Love goes out of the way to help those who don't do things quite our way. Love is patient and kind to those who come from a differing background to us. In Corinth, they're impatient and unkind. But love is patient and kind and bears with and actively seeks the good of others. And Paul goes on. Verse 4, again, love does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. And yet as a church, they were envious and boastful and proud. They boasted in their gifts and they boasted in their favorite leaders, chapter 4, verse 6. And they were proud and boastful of their knowledge, chapter 8, verse 1. They were not glad that others had gifts, they did not. They were not self-effacing and thinking first of others. They were superior and brash and proud and overconfident in their knowledge. They were quick to put others down and even quicker to put and think lower of others. But love is not like that. It is always thinking quicker of others than oneself. Love is always quicker to want to talk about others than me. Love is always concerned about others before me. See, love is not envious or boastful or proud. It's other-centered. And Paul goes on, love is not rude. It's not self-seeking, verse 5. It's not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. And yet they were rude and self-seeking and easily angered and kept records. And so they insisted on their rights without regard to the feeling of others. They ate in the temples of the idols, despite the fact that others in the church were horrified by what they were doing. Chapter 8. And far from forgiving and forgetting and making light of wrongs, they took one another to court. Chapter 6, verse 1. See, loving people, that is, people who love, don't take advantage of others. They don't ride roughshod over them. Loving people don't insist on their rights. They give them up to maintain unity and love and peace. Loving people are not touchy or prickly. They have a long fuse, not a short fuse. Loving people are not resentful. They prefer to wipe clean the slate. Loving people don't recall the harsh word or that foolish event or that unkind act. Love is not rude. It's not self-seeking. It's not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. And love does not delight in evil, verse 6. It doesn't rejoice in wrongdoing. It rejoices in the truth. And yet the Corinthians delighted in evil. They rejoiced in wrongdoing. And so some of them were sleeping with prostitutes, chapter 6. And they were not shocked by the sexual relationship of one of their members with their own stepmother, chapter 5. They embraced their culture. They delighted even in its wickedness. But loving people who love, don't rejoice or delight in wrong. They're saddened by wrong. And so when they hear songs or see films that delight in wickedness, that are contrary to the purposes of God, they're saddened, they're crestfallen. They're saddened when they witness wrong behavior and evil and wickedness in their own lives and the lives of others. And loving people, they don't seek to be superior or gloat over others. That's not a distinctive of love. See, it's not a distinctive of love to be always tracking down and pointing out what is wrong in others. But that doesn't mean it's not saddened. And of course, the flip side is to love and to rejoice in what is right, to seek the good in others, to encourage the good, to delight in the work of God in others, rather than seeing all their faults. Because love delights in the God of love and the God of truth. And love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. See, unlike the Corinthians who live for the moment, love takes the long view. Love is astonishingly resilient. It's not suspicious and cynical. It seeks to believe the best about others. It doesn't give up on people. It's prepared to offer a second chance and to forgive even 70 times 7. Doesn't mean love is naive or gullible. Calvin expressed it this way. Love would rather be deceived by its gentleness of heart than injure a brother by suspicion. It's always ready to think the best, to put the most favorable construction on anything. That is why love never ceases to hope for God's best in every life and every situation. No hardship or reversal or rebuff can ever stop love from loving. It always trusts and hopes and perseveres. And of course, as we read these words, we have to ask ourselves, we see, don't we, how the Corinthians fell short when judged against the measure of, of this divine standard. But what about us? And of course, as we read this in context, we see now why Paul does and says what he says. And he writes to a church that is so concerned with its glory and its honour and to be seen as spiritual than to love. But I wonder what Paul would say to us. You know, as we put a mirror up against our hearts, how do we fare? See, would people think of us as patient and kind and other-centred, as those who are quick to forgive and quick not to hold grudges or grievances, those who seek to look for the best in others, more concerned to love than to be boast or to be well thought of? See, the truth is, isn't it, we all so easily want to be thought of as spiritual and wise, even powerful. And we love to attend conferences that hail such things. But shouldn't we first be praying that the Holy Spirit would work in our hearts to produce the fruit of a Christ-like character, love? See, would it not be a great thing that we were known at Christ Church Haywards Heath, not as a church that demonstrated great spiritual gifts, not even as a church that taught the Bible so faithfully and theologically well, not even as a church that has such great children's and youth groups and programs, not, although all those things are good, but wouldn't it be good that we were known as a church that loved? That when people spoke of Christ Church Haywards Heath members, they said of them, they're so patient. They're so kind. They don't get easily angered. They don't speak of themselves. They speak of others. They're concerned for others. They're always looking for the best in others. Wouldn't it be a great thing that those in Haywards Heath and in the surrounding villages and in mid-Sussex thought of Christ Church Haywards Heath above all the other good things that we would want to be distinguished as and known for, but primarily to be known as a church that loved, that was Christ-like in its love for others, in the way in which it spoke and dealt with others. Wouldn't that be a great thing? And Paul says, look, here's the reason. The reason why you want to keep focusing on love is because love never ends. Love never ends. Verses 8 to 13. See, the Corinthians were convinced they had reached the ultimate spiritual state, that they were spiritually superior while others were not, because they spoke in tongues and they prophesied. They had words of knowledge, and yet, as Paul has shown us, they failed in love. And of course, the irony was that the very things they so treasured, the very things that they so held highly, would pass away, were transient. Whereas love, the thing they failed in, never ended. It never failed. See verse 8, love never fails, or better would be, never ends. It just keeps going. But Paul goes on, but where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part. Love goes on. All these other things will cease. Now, of course, the question we need to ask then is, well, when does that happen? When do tongues and prophecies cease? And Paul tells us, verse 10, when perfection comes. But when is that? Well, there are two possible options, and both are held by Bible-believing evangelicals like us. The first is that when Paul speaks of perfection in verse 10, he's speaking of the maturity of the church. And the argument goes, because the word Paul uses here is often linked in this way to the church and is seen elsewhere in Scripture, places like Ephesians 4. And they would argue that this maturity of the church happens at the completion of the canon. That is when the Bible is complete. That, they would say, is when our knowledge is full. And as such, there'll be no need for prophecies and words of knowledge. Because at that point, we will have God's complete revelation for us. And therefore, all such gifts will cease. These gifts were just for the apostolic period, and we should therefore not expect these gifts at all today. Maturity in that sense has arrived. The second position is to understand the perfection in verse 10 as looking to Jesus' second coming. And the argument goes like, well, if Paul was talking about these gifts ceasing with the completion of Scripture, why would he not just say that? And could Paul have really had that in mind? Furthermore, the argument goes, the language used in verse 12, where we see him talking about seeing face to face, seems to be speaking of us seeing Jesus, which will happen when Jesus comes. And the language of knowing fully, again, seems to be an end-time thing. Even with the completion of the Bible, I don't know fully, and I certainly don't know myself fully. Now, of course, if one holds that position, well, then that opens up questions about gifts of prophecy and tongue and their purposes for today. And chapter 14 gives us insight into that. Now, for me, it seems that Paul is speaking about Jesus' second coming. That seems to fit best with his argument that he's seeking to make, that, look, gifts are transient, but love never ends. Gifts will cease, but love won't. And so his argument seems to go, look, investing all one's energies in such gifts and failing to recognize the priority of love was a serious error because love never ends, but of course the gifts will. And we can see how that then fits in with the rest of what he says in verses 11 and 12 and verse 10. See, for verse 10, when perfection comes, the imperfect disappears. There'll be no need for spiritual gifts because then the church will be perfected and matured. There'll be no need for words of knowledge or any more prophecies from God as we will then know fully. And Paul uses two illustrations to highlight this. He says it is like verse 11. When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. And when I was a child, talking, thinking, reasoning like a child, that was perfectly all right. But when I became a man, I put childish ways behind me. So it was no longer appropriate for me to talk and think and reason like a child as a man. Now, Paul is not saying that tongues and prophecy is childish. Rather, he is saying that however much we may mature in Christian character and behavior in this life, as we indeed should, yet at best, it will only be a childhood compared with our full adult status of complete maturity in heaven. So to focus on the gifts now rather than love is to live as if there's no life beyond the nursery. It's to live as if one was a child forever rather than recognizing and living in light of something far greater to come. Think about it like this. When we're teaching our children to talk, they start off by trying to make sounds, and then they start to say words, and they don't quite say the words correctly, and we correct them, and they don't quite get the tense right, and so we have to teach them about tenses and when to use the past tense and not the present tense, and you help them to learn, don't you? Why? Because you don't want them speaking in that way when they get into adulthood. You're working towards adulthood. And Paul's saying, look, the gifts of prophecy and tongues, they're okay for whilst we're in this world, whilst we're in effect children. But actually, we're not going to be needed them when we are adults, when we're in heaven. And so he's saying, look, don't spend all your time and energy and focus on these gifts now, which are for whilst you are children. Think of those things and work towards what you're going to be like when you're in heaven, adults. In other words, focus on love. Love is what endures. Love is what never ends. The gifts are transient. He says similarly, verse 12. Now I see a poor reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully. These gifts, tongues and prophecies are like a poor reflection in a mirror. But you see, when perfection comes, no longer is the mirror needed and the reflection is replaced with reality. Gifts will no longer be needed. Perfection removes all the imperfect precursors. In other words, you think about it like doing an exam. Not an exam, but my mind goes like this. Teachers always said to me in the exams, kind of doing your A-levels or GCSE, isn't it? look at how much the question is worth. Because what's the danger? You get into the exam, you spend all your time working on question one, and question one is only worth 5 marks. And the problem is you leave only 5-10 minutes to do question three, which is worth 25 marks. And Paul's saying, look, focusing all on the gifts and tongues and prophecies now, you're focusing on the 5-mark question rather than the 25-mark question, which is love. That's what's going to endure. That is what's going to keep going. So focus on love. Keep going with love. Invest in love. Because, verse 13, the climax of his argument, these three remain, faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. Faith remains. People think, well, how does faith remain? You know, surely I no longer need faith because I'm seeing God. Well, yes. But actually, faith is simply just trusting in God. And that will always be the case. We'll always be those whose faith is in God. Likewise with hope. Hope will always remain because my hope will always be in Christ. And love continues and is the greatest because love is the very currency, as it were, of heaven. It's the all-embracing virtue. It's foundational. It's what characterizes God's people, just as it characterizes God. Love is what marks us. See, are you more concerned with the transient, with investing in what is transient, or with that which will last forever? See, are you more concerned with becoming a person who loves, or a person who is gifted, super spiritual? And Paul says our priority has to be love. And of course, we want to be equipping and developing all the other gifts God has given us, but are we desiring to be those who love? So this week, how will you grow in your love for others? How will you deepen your love towards others? How will you move towards others and seek others and listen to others' stories and be more concerned for others than yourself this week? How will you love? How will you put on the things that Paul is speaking of in verses 4 to 7 this week? How will you be patient? How will you be kind? How will you trust and hope and persevere in love?